Coming up today, China has landed on the moon. A new study suggests that people in vegetative states can react emotionally to loved ones. And academic publisher Elsevier is accused of declaring war on science. Also, Twitter and Facebook seem to be annoying users with some new features, and the NSA is launching a PR campaign in a bid to claw back public trust. All that and more coming up. Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to moon landings and NSA PR campaigns. I'm your host, Olivia Solon, and I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Leanne Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
Now, it's all ladies this week. Nate is on his Christmas holly bears, which is very exciting for him. And this is also the last regular podcast we'll be doing until the second week of January. Although I would like to point out we do have a couple of specials this week. In addition to our regular podcast, we have the Wired World in 2014 episode. And that'll be where the Mag team talks about their predictions for next year. They look into the little crystal balls. And then Boxing Day, we have an excellent treat, which is the Games and Gear special, where Nate is actually talking alongside his brother Andy about all the things that you should have bought for Christmas that you didn't, all the stuff you didn't get. And then in January, in the first week, we'll have a Wired.co.uk 2013 year in review special, where we picked out our favourite stories.
Which it was is a great year.
We've recorded it already, but you don't get to hear it for a couple of weeks. Now, before we get started on the news, I just wanted to talk about some feedback we had from one of our very loyal listeners, Ian Connerton, and he was commenting on a story we spoke about last week about National Geographic teaming up with Google Maps to overlay historical maps and information. And he said, "I had to laugh when Liv mentioned Nottingham's original name. Yes, it's true. In Saxon times, it was called Snottingham. It literally translates as home of the snot, but snot was actually a local clan slash family as opposed to the mucus that we know and love now." And he says, "Having said that, Nottingham is no longer snotty and well worth a visit from an innovation perspective. Pop up and see us and I'll buy you a pint in one of the oldest pubs in England." So thanks, Ian, and happy Christmas. We'll be taking you up on the offer, won't we?
Yes, he has definitely a lot of information there. I feel like he's from the tourist board.
Yeah. He's not from the tourist board, but he perhaps he should be getting some sort of kickback from them. Yeah. But anyway, let's get on with the news. First up, China has landed a rover on the moon. Now, this is the first moon landing in about 40 years, and the rover is called Jade Rabbit, and it was a name that was chosen through an online poll, and it refers to a popular Chinese myth about a rabbit that lives on the moon, which is amazing.
That is just lovely.
But anyway, this little rover is going to be testing lots of new technologies and gathering scientific data, and it also seems to show that China is now a very leading contender in the modern space race. It landed in a wonderfully sounding place, a volcanic plain on the moon called the Bay of Rainbows.
Who names these?
Don't you just imagine unicorns just, to be kind of trotting around there?
It sounds amazing, but don't you need quite complex weather systems to have rainbows? Well, are there actually rainbows in this bay?
Well, I guess I'll be finding out.
Yes.
And this 120-kilogram rover is going to be working for around 3 months. And there's a lander that it came down with. We'll be there for about a year. And it's got loads of instruments. It's got panoramic cameras, so it's already been sending back some pretty awesome pictures. And I'm sure we'll have plenty more of those. And it has things like a ground penetration radar to map the structure of the crust as far as several hundred feet down, UV camera, telescope, etc., etc.
So what's the grand plan from China? Do we know what are they scooping out for?
World domination.
Well, of course.
Well, and in fact, universal domination. No, China's actually paving the way eventually for a crewed mission to the moon in 2020s.
Oh, that is not far away.
It sounds like a long time away, but it's actually pretty damn close. Wow. So I think they've got another mission in the interim where they're going to send out some more instruments in a couple of years' time, and then manned next.
Exciting times.
Very exciting.
Put a flag up there.
Leah, next up we have quite a worrying piece of news, in my opinion, is that brain scans have shown that some people in vegetative states are actually reacting emotionally to their loved ones.
Yeah, it's a very interesting study done by a team of neuroscientists in Israel, focusing on individuals classed as being in a vegetative state, which in this study was 1 month or longer. I think some of them had been more than 3 months. And they found that regions of the brain that process emotional significance and autobiographical information, so knowledge of your own history, as being activated in these patients, which, like you say, is a little bit troubling because our knowledge of consciousness is so tiny.
So hang on, just explain what constitutes a vegetative state.
Okay, so basically it's when there has been damage to the individual's cognitive functions. They've had a brain injury, so there's no awareness of themselves and their environment. They don't appear to perceive or comprehend or react to their environment in any way. However, they do appear to kind of be awake and fall asleep, and sometimes can do kind of basic motor functions like chewing food, but they don't respond to any stimuli in their environment. They won't respond to you if you talk to them, they won't demonstrate if they're experiencing pain. Okay. So it seems as if they have no awareness.
And so how do they test this emotional awareness, I guess?
So what they did, they'd had just, it's a very small test group, just four patients, and they had a control group of 13 healthy volunteers, and they showed them all unfamiliar faces, photos of unfamiliar people. And in both the healthy and the individuals in a vegetative state, they displayed activity in the regions of the brain responsible for processing visual information, cognitive information, and emotional information. So when they moved on to familiar faces, photos of loved ones, there was significant activity in the limbic and salient networks of the brain in both groups of people. Now, these areas are responsible for processing our emotional lives and our memories. The salient networks are related to memory and context, so putting that face in an emotional context. So they are obviously were very excited and thought these people are experiencing some kind of emotional perception of their environment. You know, we can't tell if that is awareness in the same way that we would comprehend awareness. It might be an automatic function. But they took it one step further to see if it could be more than an automated reaction, and asked the individuals to just think of a parent's face. They didn't show them anything. And in two of the patients in a vegetative state, they in fact, the same areas in the limbic region were activated, which they say suggests is really strong evidence to say that they are perceiving their environment in an emotional way.
So when they're testing to see if someone is in fact in a vegetative state, are they not normally looking at these parts of the brain?
I think standard testing is if you're reacting to your environment in any way, you know, pain, any kind of cognitive expression.
Yeah.
But emotional awareness obviously is not something, this is something they're using fMRI scans to see which areas of the brain are being activated. And I mean, it could be that this is a way of testing a patient's for misdiagnosis or their future prognosis, because those two patients, in fact, this is pretty key bit of information, didn't remain in a vegetative state.
Oh.
It's not like they didn't have a dramatic recovery, but they moved into what's classed as a minimally conscious state. So they started responding to stimuli, which someone in a vegetative state would not do.
So it could sort of prove perhaps a good test in future for people to find out whether they've got a chance of improving.
I think they know so little right now because it was such a small test group, but it kind of gives you hope that they were saying this could be tested so that we could find out if certain patients would be more amenable to rehabilitation therapies, because I think generally, you know, someone in a vegetative state does not have a good prognosis, and that, you know, there is no cure. But it's kind of terrifying because it just shows how little we know. Like for the researchers, they found it really interesting because they thought, you know, in the future, this will hopefully help us understand what consciousness is.
Yeah. For the people in these states, you don't.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a study I think you reported, was it earlier this year or perhaps last year, where they were using a test to get people to imagine playing tennis to answer yes or no.
Yes.
And they discovered that people who they thought couldn't communicate at all, but, you know, via means of like winking or blinking or whatever people normally do, could actually communicate by
exactly
exercising a different part of their brain. rain.
Yeah, that was kind of almost kind of crushing because you realise this person's been in this state this whole time. I think that was a man, a Canadian guy, who'd been in a vegetative state, persistent vegetative state, for 12 years. And like you say, it's not someone who suffers from locked-in syndrome. Their brainstem's damaged and they're physically paralysed. They can't, but maybe they can wink or make some kind of gesture. But he'd shown no sign of awareness, and they trained him. I think it was, pretend you're playing tennis for yes or football for no. And it was different areas of the brain that were igniting. And they could ask him if he was in pain, and he said no, and which was obviously something to take away from it. But you realise he's been conscious to some degree for those for 12 years. Well, I don't know what portion of those 12 years maybe he wasn't.
Imagine
but
the things he listened to in that time. Well, let's move on from that slightly bleak topic. Next up, we want to talk about Twitter making a change and then immediately reversing the decision and everyone getting very angry about it. Katie?
Yes. So Twitter's been making quite a lot of little tweaks recently, but last week it introduced changes to its block functionality. So whereas before, if you blocked someone, that would kind of block them completely, they wouldn't be able to follow you, they wouldn't be able to even see you, and they wouldn't be able to interact with you, Twitter changed it so that in effect it was a one-way block, so you wouldn't be able to see them. And you wouldn't, if they attempted to interact with you, you wouldn't be able to see that. But they would still be able to follow you, and they would still be able to respond to your tweets. Mm. You just wouldn't be able to see it. So obviously people got very, very upset about this, as they tend to do when social networks sort of change the privacy rules without really telling anyone.
Halfway through the game.
Yeah. In all fairness to Twitter, it responded very, very quickly to this and realised that people were very upset. So they held a late night meeting and they decided to reverse the changes. And they published this statement on their website, which said, "Earlier today, we made a change to the way the block function of Twitter works. We've decided to revert to the change after receiving feedback from many users. We never want to introduce features at the cost of users feeling less safe. Any blocks you had previously instituted are still in effect." So basically, the reason that this was done in the first place was because it seems, initially you might think that it was a bit of a strange decision. But
why?
But the reason that they decided to do this was because apparently some users are just as worried about the kind of people retaliating to them after they've blocked them as they are about the abuse that they receive before they block them.
What does that mean? Like, what do you mean by retaliation?
So I think, I think it's, people
knowing that they've been blocked.
Realising. And then
setting up other accounts.
Bad-mouthing you all
over town. Yeah, but I think, this probably could be, getting other people involved, perhaps getting other users involved. But I suspect probably also for some users, if, it made me think of younger users, maybe if they also know these people in real life, it's a very kind of like, it's a very sort of parental thing to be like, oh, we'll just ignore them, block them and it'll go away. But, if you have a network of people that do actually know each other
That has to be quite specific circumstances, though.
Yeah.
Generally, you block weirdos that have no connection to you.
Exactly. But I think it just shows that Twitter users have kind of abuse isn't very as simple as perhaps it seems. People have different expectations, different concerns about privacy. And I think this was a sort of a mistake that Facebook made a few times, actually, where, there was like, there was this kind of attitude that there was a one-size-fits-all way of dealing with these privacy issues, which clearly there isn't at all. And also, the other thing, which is, don't change people's privacy settings without telling them.
Or maybe allow them to keep the existing ones. And
give them an extra option.
But in this case, it's a difficult one because it's a two-way relationship within a blocking situation. So if you have the two different people wanting to have different settings, it makes it quite difficult to implement.
Yeah. But anyway, so Twitter has apologised for this, but said that it's still going to try and find a way to protect people that are scared of retaliation. But as of now, the problem kind of does still exist, unfortunately.
The final piece of news before we go into our ad break is the fact that academic publisher Elsevier has been clamping down on open access websites and universities where academics are posting their own articles online. It's been sending a whole load of takedown notices for copyright infringement, and it started earlier this month when Elsevier sent 2,800 takedown notices to a site called academia.edu. And this is a site where academics can share their own research, and the idea is about kind of encouraging scientific advancement. And so the people who've worked on these papers that have, you know, some of them have been published in Elsevier, they're posting these online. And for Elsevier, this is, well, what it is, it does constitute copyright infringement, even though these guys have, you know, written this research. Elsevier's kind of edited it and had it peer reviewed and published it. So Elsevier considers, you know, thinks that these should be immediately taken down. And it also targeted academics at a university where they've been posting up their own papers onto their kind of university pages, you know, the profile pages that academics have. They've been posting their own research there. Again, takedown notices. They've been asked to them down. And a lot of people have got very angry about this. And I know this is something that, you know, there's a real movement towards open access of scientific research and a lot of antipathy, if that's the right word, towards these big academic publishers which charge huge subscriptions to universities and libraries to access what is essentially their own research.
I guess there's a way of going about it, bringing that change, and it's probably not just annoying a massive publisher.
Yeah, so you know, the angry researchers are urging people to sign up to a petition. Well, it's sort of a petition, a declaration that launched about a year ago called The Cost of Knowledge, which again is kind of asking for academics to sign up and veto Elsevier, so agreeing not to publish their work in Elsevier journals and not to peer review that work and not to be act as referees for those journals. It's quite hard because Elsevier is one of the biggest and most prestigious academic publishing organisations, but yes, it's got, I think, 14,000 academics have already signed up to this, this declaration. But anyway, I spoke to Elsevier, I spoke to their communications department, and they've kind of defended themselves, I guess rightly, saying that, you know, it only issues takedown notices for the final published version of journal articles. The researchers are free to publish their own data.
Oh my goodness, why don't they just publish the pre-edited
and that they're only focusing on kind of public sites, so researchers can kind of share it over email but not just post it on their public site.
So you could have it in like a university intranet type thing.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's not perhaps as bad as it initially seems, but the spokesman did say, I think there's in a blog post actually, said, what library will continue to subscribe if a growing proportion of articles is available for free elsewhere? That kind of highlights the exact thing that most researchers want to happen, is that research is available free elsewhere so that everyone can access it. You know, developing markets who can't afford the exorbitant prices. You know, in many cases, we've seen libraries and universities really struggling with the cost of these subscriptions. And there was a really notable example when Harvard, which is the one of the richest universities, if not the richest university in the world, actually said it can no longer afford to subscribe to these journals.
And they're giving away their lessons for free now.
Exactly. Yeah. So I suppose, yeah, the institutions and academics in a way are kind of setting a precedent with it, with those kind of courses, really.
Yeah.
They're making a statement and hoping these guys will follow. But
and I guess, you know, they if they really believe that, they're going to need to turn their back on the subscription journals. But I think still individual academics, they, you know, get a lot of kind of kudos and kind of ultimately their tenure will be based on the how prestigious the publications they publish in. And at the moment, although I think we are seeing a shift, some of the subscription journals are still deemed to be the most prestigious, at least amongst the kind of older generation of academics. Anyway, we're about to take an ad break, but when we come back, we're going to have our feature segment where we'll be discussing some of Facebook's recent changes and the NSA's attempt to charm the public.
Everyone, it's getting close to Christmas. People have time off. Some lucky people have 3 weeks off. Not making any references to myself at all there. And it's a great time to get stuck into a free audiobook, which is good because as a listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast, you're still able to get a free one with Audible.co.uk. It's still offering access to a free book from a catalogue of 80,000 titles for joining a one-month free trial, which costs no pounds and no pence. And whatever book you choose is yours to keep, listen to over the festive period, over New Year perhaps, and you can cancel your account if you don't like the service, although you may do, and that's great too, of course. So if you go to audible.co.uk/wired and sign up in a few seconds, you can be downloading any book from that catalogue and enjoying it immediately after this podcast perhaps, or after some of the specials we're doing later this week. You'll be supporting our show here every week and into the new year, and you get a free book as a thank you. So that's at audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Next up, we're going to move to our first segment, and we are putting on our jobpers and hard hats in order to ride the Technosaurus. Now, Facebook is back in the news for annoying users in two different ways as it attempts to squeeze the last remaining drops of revenue and data from the platform. Firstly, it's tracking those status updates you write and don't post. And secondly, it's launching autoplay video ads. Katie, what is going on?
Yeah, so I think quite a lot of people are finding Facebook quite irritating these days anyway. And I don't think that these latest moves are particularly going to help it much.
Yeah.
So firstly, we found out that it's collecting the things that we don't say. And you know, not only that, but perhaps it's collecting things like friend requests that we never answer or decline.
Well, it almost certainly has those because they're just sitting in our in our notifications area.
So this was found out as part of a study which was conducted by a Facebook data scientist and a Summit intern. And they tracked two things. They tracked the HTML form element where users enter original status updates or upload content, and also the comment box that allows people to add to discussions sort of underneath photos where people have already posted and that kind of thing. So a self-censored update counted as an entry into either of those boxes that was more than 5 characters long and was typed out but not submitted for the next 10 minutes. So if you sat there and went, you know, I'm not sure.
That's horrifying.
I mean, I wonder how many of them are names of exes where you've thought you've been typing into the search bar and you actually mistakenly typed into the update bar.
That would be awful. We've obviously done that.
The Ed Balls approach, but I would love to do some kind of correlation.
So anyway, they tracked 5 million users at random. You could have been one of them, over 17 then. Days, and found that during that time, 71% of those users typed out something that they did not then submit. So on average, people held back 4.52 statuses and 3.2 comments. And men were more likely to self-censor than women, especially if they had more male than female friends.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the online disinhibition effect isn't as strong as perhaps, you know, we think that everyone just says whatever they want online. But.
Yeah. So it's not actually clear whether Facebook does collect this data all the time or whether it just collected it for the study. They haven't responded to people's questions. but it still feels very intrusive, doesn't it?
You have the things you don't want to put out into the world and you've carefully mulled over them and decided, no, that's a massive mistake.
It's kind of, it's like articles you haven't published on the website somehow, someone having access.
Emails having access to your inner thoughts is what it is.
Yeah. Well, it's not quite that. You are typing it out into a comment box. But what's the second thing that's getting everyone rather riled?
Yeah, so the annoyance number two are these autoplay ads, which have been rumoured for kind of some time now, but Facebook is starting to test them this week on a small number of users, so keep your eyes peeled. You might be one of them as well. It's hoping eventually to roll this out further across mobile and desktop.
I don't know what your feed looked like in Facebook this week, but a lot of people were like, I am leaving if they do this.
Everyone always says that, and no one ever does.
I don't know. I feel like there might be a movement brewing.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll be able to disable it, surely.
Well, so The one good thing about it is that Facebook said that there won't be automatic music playing.
Oh, excellent.
Which is, yeah, for me, that is the worst bit about autoplay ads, you know, and you've got a number of tabs open and, yeah, then something just starts playing and you can hear the music and you don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah, yeah. End up closing find everything. That tab.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's that at least. But
what's the kind of justification for it?
So it's basically, as Facebook has said in its blog post about this, which you can go and look up, it's about marketers telling stories.
Of course
which
it is.
A very romantic way of saying...
showing you loads of ads.
Yeah.
And being able to charge more money for those, yeah, ads. Because traditionally, online video, it charges a much higher premium than just display ads online. Yeah. So perhaps
despite being deeply more annoying.
It depends. I mean, maybe if you're thinking about like some of these viral Christmas ads that go around, like the ability to have been able to see the John Lewis ad, the bear and the hair.
There's a difference between one of those and your page being consumed.
But I guess if you think about it in terms of those sorts of things, it's probably less annoying than,
yeah,
I don't know what else.
I'm picturing a horror show, like when I changed my status to engaged, having wedding adverts, wedding photography.
Well, you get that anyway.
No, I know, but the onslaught of videos as well, I think I'd lose my mind.
Well, they'll still keep doing that too, so.
So that almost certainly will happen. Unfortunately, you're already married, so you don't get that.
I still get it. Now it's babies.
Really?
A lot of baby related.
But yeah, and also Facebook seems to think that you actually want to watch these videos because it says as well that it will give you options to watch further videos that are related from the same marketers after you've watched them. So it seems to believe that people might want to see these as well, but we'll see about that. I mean, I don't know, has Facebook got too annoying, do you think? Do you,
yes,
think that this is, it's got, for
I
me...
think the people on Facebook are more annoying than the ads.
I was just about to say that. Yeah, I don't know, 50-50 for me right now.
And maybe if you had autoplay videos from your friends and acquaintances, I don't know what would be more annoying.
I'm constantly do not show me updates from this person anymore. And it would be great if we can use that for certain advertisers.
Yeah, I mean, the guy who I embarrassingly used to went on a few dates with, who does spoken word poetry in YouTube videos, if they were to play, that would be so embarrassing.
Olivia, I think this will be of interest to you from Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. Here's an autoplay spoken word poem. No thanks. It was about evolution though, so just
so it is
scientifically
so Facebook would
inaccurate.
Know you.
Yeah.
Sort of reminds me, I've been using one of the, it wasn't iPlayer because it doesn't have ads, but maybe Channel 4 On Demand, and they've started doing this thing where they have ads where it'll have a normal ad and then it'll give you, say, which of the next two ads do you want to watch?
Yes,
and I don't want to be part of this dirty game.
But you have if you want it to go quicker, you have to click on one.
But then if you click on it, you know that they're then feeding that back to the advertiser as like they've opted to watch your ad and maybe charging
them
a higher premium.
What they did was opt to not sit there for an extra 15 seconds before the autoplay began. That is the only reason.
I know.
And they can sell whatever they want to those, if people are stupid enough to believe it.
What do you think about Facebook autoplay videos? Email us at podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, our final segment and second segment for this podcast will be, oh no, they didn't. I always feel like a bit of a knob when I say that. But this is the story that the NSA has launched a sort of slightly awkward PR campaign around all the surveillance revelations.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed reading into this. So, as you might expect from their very first attempt at being open, transparent, public, loving, it's not doing very well. There's a few conflicting things happening. But the main thing that happened was they opened the Dorset HQ to a CBS TV crew for the programme 60 Minutes. And a few interviews were conducted with high profile members of the spy agency, including one Rick Ledgett, who is the agent headed up a task force into Edward Snowden's leaks. And he made the kind of overblown dramatic statement, which probably really doesn't mean anything, which is that it's worth having a conversation about giving Snowden amnesty. And this was suddenly like headlines everywhere. NSA wants to give them amnesty. The State Justice Department is still on the hunt to arrest him. And the director of the NSA also in the interview came out as saying like, no way. this is not going to happen.
Now, this 60 Minutes program has been like widely criticized as being a sort of puff piece for the NSA. And
yeah, it's really quite odd. I think it's kind of trying to paint them, well, from his comments, as he actually referred to the NSA as being naive, and kind of paints them as a vulnerable agency that was foolish in thinking that they had to like be clandestine and they should now be more open to the public. He actually came out with, now what you're seeing now is our new face. So they are kind of trying to rebrand themselves as this, we're trying to do very well for you guys, we're doing our duty, but we've changed, you know, we're going to be more open so that you don't have to be afraid and we can explain what we're really doing.
So they're now openly reading all of our emails.
Yeah. They're admitting to it. They think in hindsight, this was a mistake not to tell you we were reading your emails. No. So he actually did another interview with Reuters. This was the vulnerable side of the NSA, where he said they admitted the NSA is no closer to knowing exactly what Snowden took. He took something like 1.7 million documents. They've released all these figures on how many documents he took, how much money they've spent trying to find out, all the things they've put in place to try and protect themselves. And he said the things that make him afraid are whether or not he took information on specific targets. So that's potential terrorists, you know, that would have key information that could be dangerous. He said those make me nervous because they reveal what we know and what we don't know, and they're almost a roadmap for adversaries. There's the vulnerable side. And then he goes on to basically badmouth Snowden a bit in this nice way, which says basically not worthy of being called a whistleblower because that does a disservice to real whistleblowers. This, he said, is because he didn't actually bring his concerns about the NSA to the right people.
Well, hang on, he fundamentally misunderstands what a whistleblower is then.
Speak to Ledger, he seems like a reasonable guy. You know, if you go and talk to him, maybe it would have been different. He said, anytime you trust people, there is always a chance that someone will betray you. So they're really laying it on thick.
Didn't the citizens of the US and the rest of the world trust the government not to be spying on them?
Well, yes. He needed a retort. The CBS interview would have been much more engaging if you had been there. Is that opposite?
I should have been
laying
there.
Laying down the facts. All this hard work by this guy was kind of undone when the director came out and said, basically compared negotiating with Snowden to negotiating with terrorists, i.e. we're not going to do it. He said it's like a hostage taker taking 50 people hostage, shooting 10, and then saying, if you give me full amnesty, I'll let the other 40 go. We're not going to do it because it will encourage more people to do the same.
So that might be part of the discussion about whether or not to give Snowden amnesty.
Yeah.
The discussion being, we're not going to.
Exactly. Exactly. But I think the point is, Ledger is kind of trying to get it out there that, you know, he's taken all these documents. We don't know what he's taken. They're still releasing loads of stuff. Maybe we'll offer amnesty in an attempt to prevent him from releasing more documents. He'll have to make assurances to us that he will no longer release documents. And I don't know, you can't really see that happening on many levels. Like, I don't even think Snowden would want amnesty.
No, I'm not sure he wants to be back in there.
Not at this stage. He might as well just go for it now.
Yeah, you've kind of said goodbye to your whole life. You've burnt every bridge
your
imaginable.
Girlfriend.
Yeah, including your girlfriend.
Didn't get that memo until a bit late. And so, I mean, what do we think? Do we think there's any chance of the NSA restoring trust? No.
No, of course not. But I think when I was looking into it and reading about... you know, the committee, the MPs committee they had a couple of weeks ago, and the editor at The Guardian said they'd only release 1% of all the files he'd given them. You suddenly realise, like, the weight of responsibility on their shoulders for what to release and what not to release.
Yeah.
And he kind of specifically said there was stuff in there about Afghanistan and Iran, which is not relevant to his cause.
Yeah.
But he gave it to them anyway, so it's like he kind of just mass dumped it on them without filtering through and saying... this is appropriate, this is what...
But then The Guardian and other newspapers are now liaising with the NSA and with governments to try and make sure that they are acting responsibly.
Yeah, but that's a funny one, isn't it? Because presumably the NSA is going to say none of it is okay. What are they going to be agreeable about?
I guess it comes down to the public interest versus terrorist risk.
Well, now we know the NSA is... trusting, open and naive, we can trust them to tell us which is important and which is not.
Oh, poor old NSA.
I feel sorry for them.
Yeah, well, if you feel sorry for them, tell us about it. Why don't you email us on podcast@wired.co.uk? And that, my friends, is all we've got time for. This is the last podcast that we'll be on before Christmas.
Sad times.
Very sad times.
But Merry Christmas.
But yes, yeah.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
It's a bittersweet pill.
And I hope you get all the goodies that you had asked Santa for. But as I said at the beginning, there are a few special podcasts we've got coming up. This week we have the Wired World in 2014 with all the Mag team, hearing their lovely voices. And then next week, Thursday, Boxing Day, Games and Gear special. And then there'll be Thursday, the 2nd of January, we'll have our 2013 year in review, where we picked out our most ridiculous, amusing and interesting stories from the year. On that note, I'll say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.